Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast with me, Helen Lewis, and my absent co-host, Stephen Bush, who will not be absent later. He will be, in fact, talking to you about Kezia Dugdale's resignation as Scottish Labour leader, what on earth is going on with Brexit, and the burning question of the summer, can you be friends with a Tory? Welcome back, Stephen. No, hang on a minute. Continuing to welcome you back after last week where you were also back.
I was also back.
That's how much I've blotted out the bong fest of last week. I wanted to talk to you about Kezia Dugdale, if that's okay. I am interested in your take. So she resigned on Tuesday night, quite late, unhelpfully for our print deadline. Thank you very much. Her and Donald Trump are on a kind of mission to ruin the magazine's timeliness as leader of Scottish Labour. Now, talk me through who the possible replacements are.
Well, so I'm slightly nervous and more people will rule themselves out as I do this.
Okay, so let's talk about the initial field, because we know someone already has ruled themselves out, right?
Neil Findlay, who ran against Jim Murphy in 2014.
Whose book cover depicts him, Jeremy Corbyn and Owen Jones against a crowd of activists, and I think it's called Socialism and Hope. So I think that kind of gives you the idea of where he is placed within the party.
So I think, like, Neil Findlay's one of those politicians who, like, he's a bit like John Cruddas, right? Except, well, from a slightly different bit of the party. But a lot of people I respect rate him. I really, in both cases, have never quite got it. And he does have, like, weird unforced gaffes.
Well, he was in a big Twitter row with Jerry Hassan, Scottish commentator, who wrote a piece about Scottish Labour's need to be more radical, basically. And then he just kind of decided to, much like my great Twitter row with Richard Bergen, I did think, come on, this is a bit beneath you.
God, I realise he has become the Chris Marshall of this leadership race. Like, he's ruled himself out. He wasn't ever in it, but he is sort of...
And you're piling in and giving him a
kicking
anyway.
But nonetheless, people have to be like, yeah, we don't think you'd be any good at this.
So Alex Rowley, her deputy, is currently acting an interim
Currently acting
leader.
And may run. Richard Leonard, who hasn't been an MSP very long, but is well-connected in the movement, may run. Jenny Barrow may run. Anna Sawa, who again is kind of like Labour establishment royalty, may run.
And it's all MSPs so far, right? I think is significant and does reflect the change since the Jim Murphy era when he was
I think
an MP.
So there are a couple of sort of interesting factors. One is that obviously she's given her reasons for the resignation, which says, like, you know, I want to do other things with my life and I've got the party to a point where it is stronger than it was when I inherited it and I can pass it on. There is an element of the fact that, like, people were circling and there was some pressure, whether or not that meant the personal stuff, you kind of go like, well, I kind of want to leave and I might as well go. But because the timing of it has caught a lot of people on the hop, it does mean that there is not yet a Corbynite or a left candidate that is certainly nailed on. I've been talking to a lot of people this morning who have kind of gone like, well, we thought this was going to happen, but we were not expecting it to happen now. Nonetheless, membership of all political parties moves closer and closer to its current leader. Liberal Conservatives leave because they don't like Citizens of Nowhere. Diehard Remainers have started to leave the Labour Party, etc., etc. They move towards and start to resemble their leader. So you would assume that the Owen Smith lead will have been eroded by that. And also, don't forget that a lot of people who voted for Owen Smith did so because they worried primarily about electability.
So that's the fact that the majority of Scottish Labour members voted for Owen Smith in the 2016 leadership election.
Yeah, so one's assumption would be that even though at the moment there is some uncertainty about who the candidate will be from the left, then the candidate from the left will win. Regardless, of course, the big difference is that all internal elections in the Labour Party till at least 2022 and very probably until at least midway through whatever kind of Labour-hinged government emerges after the next election, will be through the prism of what I've always liked about myself is Jeremy kind of lens, right? So even if the person who wins privately doesn't think Jeremy Corbyn is all that, they will not be an explicit Corbyn sceptic in the way...
The Burnham Gambit, one might call
yeah,
it.
Yeah, the Burnham Gambit. Yeah.
So I think it's time to appraise a bit about Kezia Dugdale's legacy. I interviewed her just after she'd taken over. Actually, I went up to Edinburgh. A, she's just genuinely quite a nice, friendly person. She had a nice chat about how she always wanted to become a lawyer because she'd watched Ally McBeal at university. She was quite human in that sense. I mean, I think essentially she was a victim of the glass cliff, which was no one else wanted. You know, Jim Murphy had had to leave that position after having presided over an absolutely catastrophic meltdown. Absolutely down to one MP from this kind of time, only 10 years before when Scottish Labour was this huge, venerable institution. And she was essentially the kind of like, you know, here's the dog poo, tidied away kind of candidate, right? Someone ran against her, Ken McDonald.
Ken McIntosh.
But that was really more for appearance's sake than kind of anything else, just to make it look like it wasn't a complete lemon. But she did stabilise them. But she, I mean, did, one of the things I think is, I think is a really interesting thing is that she went into the Holyrood elections promising to restore the 50p tax rate, right?
Yeah.
She actually kind of called the SNP's bluff about their anti-austerity credentials by saying, well, actually, you know what? I think rich people should pay a bit more tax. And guess what? She got slaughtered. Like, Labour came in third in that, behind the Conservatives. So I think there's a really interesting reflection there about what actually Scottish politics wants, why people who vote for the SNP, what they're really voting for.
The difficulty I feel always with assessing leaders of the Scottish Labour Party in recent times is, in some ways, once Wendy Alexander didn't get to do what she wanted to do in 2007, which is go, you've won, let's have this referendum on independence now. Okay, thanks, bye, and held a referendum pre-financial crisis with a popular Scottish Prime Minister in Westminster. Once you don't do that, in many ways, you can make a really strong argument that every decision that every other Scottish Labour leader made has been like pressing a series of buttons that you would ideally not want to have a choice of pressing. Nonetheless, I do think that the result last year in the devolved elections was quite a bad one, and my instinct was that it was probably avoidable. The penny for Scotland idea had already not worked with the SNP because you can basically only very crudely raise taxes on income in terms of the devolved power. You can basically put a penny on everything.
Was this the hypothecated tax for the NHS? And where am I getting?
So the SNP had already done what the Scottish Labour Party did in 2016 and similarly got a really bad result. They also had the problem that they kind of tried to be the party of the shrug as far as the union question was concerned in 2016, and that didn't work either. So kind of her two big tactical gambits, both of which, you know, at the time you can make a case for, did not work, right? So I think that has to be fairly
damning assessment.
Then I think the
But the manner of her leaving is definitely, I mean, and there was a pointed line in the resignation statement which obviously referred back to Johan Lamont leaving in, I want to say, 2014?
15. When 14.
14,
yeah.
When she said Ed Miliband has treated Scottish Labour like a branch office, which was like the biggest bruise you possibly could have punched. I mean, you might say it was true. And actually what it meant was that Kezia Dugdale was then able to get essentially a kind of fully federal party through, right? She was able to get much more autonomy as a result, which is probably for the best. But her departure has not left them in the lurch, right? It feels like a natural break. And actually the way done it has not kind of, she's not exited tossing a hand grenade over her shoulder.
I know, I did love that paragraph, which began with, I do not leave with any grudges.
I'm not going to brief against
like,
people.
I'm not going to have a press conference. Bam, Lamont, bam, Murphy. Two light hits at her immediate predecessors. There's not going to be any briefing from me. Again, some more hits from immediate predecessors. Which, I mean, is, you know, fair enough. I think it is certainly true that, and I think one of the reasons why there would, I think, have been a challenge against her at some point, is that after 2016, that job was just incredibly unattractive looking because they'd just come third. Everyone's like, are you going to die? Now, after the 2017 election, it looks not only like Scottish Labour is not going to die, but there are a large swathe of SNP-held seats where Labour are very closely in second, and so it's an attractive...
Well, that's what was really interesting about the kind of Corbyn-Scottish tour, right? Because there was mewing from the SNP about why are you not going to Tory seats. Amazing chutzpah from the SNP as ever. Like, I thought, you know, I thought we had something. I thought we were going to take on Tory austerity together. Okay, yeah. But actually, in tactical terms, it was exactly right. Those are the seats Corbyn should be going to because it's SNP-held seats that are Labour's target.
They are basically nowhere in any of those seats.
I think it's Jim Murphy's old seat is the first Tory-held seat that they could win, right?
Yeah, and even then it's like a big, like, well, good luck with that. But, I mean, I think the fascinating question, and this is not... This is honestly a question which no one, I think, is equipped to answer yet, because obviously elections are so situation-specific, right? Then you can make a strong case, and I instinctively think it's about right, that the enthusiasm for Corbyn resulted in direct defections of that, yeah, very small amount, but that 1 in 10 yes voters who defected back to the Labour Party, and their kind of ambiguity on some of the constitutional things meant that they were the biggest beneficiaries of tactical voting, even though they did not win as many seats as the Conservatives. But there is another argument, which, yeah, like in terms of the available information, stacks up exactly as well, which is actually the real story of the 2017 election in Scotland was just the SNP collapsing, right? So take Kirkcaldy, Gordon Brown's old seat. They actually won that back with a lower share of the vote than they lost it. In three of the seven seats that they won, they actually got fewer votes than in 2015. It was just that the SNP vote went way down. And that's also true in most of the places where the March...
Yeah, but that's the whole story of the 2017 election, which doesn't ever get told, right? It's the kind of idea that same thing happened with the Tories, you know, they will never ever get any credit for the fact that they dramatically increased the Conservative vote share because relative, you know, because you don't win on absolutes, right?
It's all relative. It's first past the post, right? Like, but the big question is then what people always forget about, like, oh, was our candidate inspiring? Is in an odd way, if you are inspired by the message of change of leaving the United Kingdom and then you're inspired by Corbyn, there are two things you can do. You can actually go, you know, I'm happy with both and I've been asked to vote like an inordinately large number of times. I'm okay. I like both of these. I'll stay home. You've actually still weirdly done better if you're the Scottish Labour Party by inspiring people, even if they haven't voted for you. You can inspire people and they directly vote for you, or you can not demoralise people, right? And you can make an argument and that's what the SNP did. We basically won't ever really know because, yeah, elections are situation specific. But it is quite difficult, I think, to make any data-led case that the Scottish result in 2017 was really about the leadership of the party in Scotland. And they very much did fight the Scottish election. Paul Sweeney, one of the new Scottish Labour MPs, was like, we fought our election like it was an Edinburgh South by-election. They had a thing of, we need to hold what we have, we need to hold on to Ian Murray. On the whole, I think a lot of the criticisms of like, oh, Labour's campaign was in the wrong place and they'd have won more seats, actually isn't true, because the thing about election campaigns is the reason why they tend to cancel each other out, and you saw this in Putney, right? The Conservatives knew, even though they did not know what was going on in the rest of England, that they had a distinct problem in Putney. So they moved a lot of resources back there, and it actually didn't really matter that Labour had moved some resources there as well, because it cancelled each other out. What tends to happen, and you see this basically in all elections, is that if your field campaign moves where it thinks its frontier is, even if the other campaign thinks that you might be mad, they will go like, okay, well, we'd better put more staff in. So probably in England and Wales, if Labour had fought a more offensive campaign, the Tories would have fought a more defensive campaign, and you just end up with the same result, sort of by default. The big but in Scotland, however, is of course the SNP can't move, is already defending the existing sets of seats. It has no offensive frontier anyway,
yeah,
right?
I think that's the thing that you have to remember when you think about that SNP result, is that the tie could only ever go out for them, right?
Yeah, which does mean that you can make a much better argument, although obviously in terms of the actual parliamentary arithmetic, in terms of like a hung parliament, SNP seat, Labour seat, that makes the square root of NAFL difference in terms of who goes to Buckingham Palace.
Quick final thing, which is, I think it's interesting, obviously the leaders of Welsh and Scottish Labour have a seat on the NEC, Labour's ruling council, where rule changes are enacted. Of all the candidates we've seen, I know we don't have the final list yet, you would expect them to be at least publicly pro-Corbyn, whatever their underlying politics, whether or not they are a true believer, whether or not they're somebody who's a kind of from the Just Make It Work faction. That's going to make things easier for Corbyn to get stuff that he wants done on the NEC?
In practice, I don't think it will change anything, because in terms of the union allocation, Unite at the moment has this quite large chunk because UKAT and another trade union embarrassing life, which has been absorbed into Unite, which means at the moment Unite has an outsized number of delegates on Labour's ruling NEC. They will lose one, possibly to Unison, because they are one of Labour's biggest unions, and that means that you go from having a solid vote to a swing vote. So actually, what I expect it will mean is by the end of party conference, the balance will be the same, i.e. hung, with more genuine swing voters on it, though. At the moment, you kind of go, it's hung, but there are in practice maybe four people who might actually change their mind about anything.
And can I mention one more thing, which is I think that it highlights again the Labour's structural woman problem, because all of the candidates, with the exception of one that we talked about, who might replace Kezia Dugdale, are men. You've got a man as London mayor, Manchester mayor, in fact, all the metro mayors, Carwyn Jones in Wales. Although Jeremy Corbyn has a gender balanced cabinet and has, you know, Diane Abbott and Emily Thornberry and Angela Rayner in kind of senior frontline positions, it's still kind of pushing uphill a bit, right, on some of that stuff. And I also think there is an interesting secondary sound, which I don't understand what it's about, is that more women have sacrificed their careers to criticise Jeremy Corbyn than men in the Labour Party.
Yeah, it is.
There's been lots of male critics of Jeremy Corbyn, don't get me wrong. You've got your John Manns and people like that, but they weren't people who were heading for, you know, shadow cabinet glory, who then aborted that.
Yeah, no, I think that's the fascinating, because, yeah, in some ways, I mean, obviously the Labour Party is frequently annoying, but the slight disingenuousness of some of the reaction and some of the briefing yesterday of either people going, no, 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 no one on the left wanted Kez to go, it's just like, okay, pull the other one.
It plays the red flag.
Then you have people going, oh, it's disgraceful, disgraceful, and the leader of the Labour Party should ideally want someone...
An ideological ally and supporter.
They were going to, like, be left carping on the sidelines if he won. It's just like, okay, wind your neck in. But yeah, as you say, Carwyn Jones very much decided, actually, do you know what, I'm not going to be involved in this fight down in London. Kez obviously decided she was... because of how things worked out, that probably did always mean her days were numbered. I have no idea why that is. It is a really interesting...
Yeah, it might be purely coincidental, but, you know, when you think about the really, really, I think, effective practical criticisms that have been of Corbyn's leadership, I'm not talking about your kind of your Chris Leslie's or your John Manns or, you know, people like that who just, you know, they sort of just hate the whole idea. When I'm talking about people who've tried and failed to work with Corbyn, actually it's been women. It's been Lillian Greenwood's piece, for example, I think is one of them, or Cheam Wara, who have actually made, I think, the most compelling criticisms of his leadership.
Yeah, it is quite striking in a way, like if you're Chris Leslie, it's not like there was a parallel universe in which you had like a glittering front bench career under Corbyn. Whereas, I mean, the fascinating thing, and the thing I realised I did kind of underestimate Sadiq about, is I would not have expected him to endorse Owen Smith, particularly because it was clear at that point that Owen Smith was going to get, like, womped.
No, that was a rare kind of futile gesture, you know, kind of futile but correct and standing by your principles gesture from Sadiq, who was otherwise an extremely tactical politician. Witness his tacking hard to the left during the primaries, where he talked about how he'd been one of the people who put Jeremy Corbyn on the ballot, and then going straight into a Mail on Sunday interview where he said, I don't know if I've ever mentioned that I love the Queen, love that Queen, to kind of then put some distance between him and Jeremy Corbyn. So... yeah, well done, Sadiq. But, you know, it has it also kind of slightly a cost-free thing to him, given that he wasn't up for election for... I mean, he can tack back Corbyn Woods before he comes up
for
re-election.
He's got a long, long time.
Yeah.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Stephen.
Yeah.
Do we have to talk about Brexit?
Yes, we do, I'm afraid. So the negotiations have reached a slight impasse as we speak, although maybe by the time this arrives in listeners'
inboxes... Oh yeah, they'll have definitely sorted it all out by tomorrow.
Whatever the equivalent of a podcast inbox is.
Ears.
Box. When it arrives in listeners' ears, maybe that will all have changed. So the central issue of contention is the ideal time frame as far as, I mean, obviously there's only 2 years overall in Article 50. There are now less than 2 years available. Is that you would deal with the kind of legacy issues. So the question of the UK's outgoing commitments, a second thing I can't remember, and the state of the Northern Irish border, or at least you'd have made sufficient progress on
trade
those.
Trade arbitration, presumably. ACJ judgment, accepting the rule of the ACJ.
Oh, no, citizens' rights. Because basically there's the manner of leaving, and then there's the future relationship, and you have to have sufficient progress to move on. The difficulty is, on the EU side, you probably can't actually have a resolution on the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic without having some idea what the future relationship is. Ditto in terms of the size of the so-called divorce bill. If, for example, the United Kingdom is going to continue to participate in Europol, European research projects, and pay into those, obviously there is no need for that to be included in its ongoing liabilities. So the UK government does have a point that the divide is slightly, not just arbitrary, but doesn't quite work.
Mm.
There's quite a big but coming, though, which is that they don't need to resolve these issues. They just need to be able to demonstrate some form of progress. And in all of those issues, if the British government took the process somewhat seriously, yeah, and not in this kind of weird thing of, like, we have to, like, trick these guys and
we'll
have
to go over and show Johnny Foreigner a taste of hard British steel,
yeah,
and then
I mean,
he'll cave in our favour.
So,
yeah.
For example, what is the issue on the budget, right? It's basically the other creditor nations of the EU, France, Germany, et cetera, are worried that when Britain leaves, they will be on the hook for a larger chunk of payments, right? So one of the many mistakes Theresa May has made in the Brexit talks is because of allowing a lot of this nonsense talk of, oh, we won't pay a single penny to run over. What that has then encouraged is increasingly silly numbers to emerge from EU member states and the parliament in a view of like, well, if you're saying no to a number we think is reasonable, we clearly have to go 100 billion in the hope of getting a reasonable amount. What the UK should have done before it triggered Article 50 is come up with a formula it would accept, right? So we think that X number of years of payments into the investment fund should be taken out. We think Y number of proportion of the buildings that have been bought by money that the UK has contributed. And we also want to continue to pay into the following number of programmes. And all of this should set the final budget, right? So you ought to have been able to get to an agreement on that quite quickly. But instead, there's been ridiculous, like, oh, we need to show we're tough, we're going to walk away at some point, which, like, one, it doesn't work because basically everyone on the other side thinks it would be crazy.
Yeah, madman theory only works really when people think you're either actually genuinely think you're mad or think that they're like a nuclear war, they think it will damage them too,
yeah,
as equivalent to you.
There's a great sort of game theory paper about it. Yes, it's time for
it's
some
time
game
for
theory.
Some game theory, how exciting.
But, you know, it's basically you've got two colliding cars, right? And some drivers swerve and some don't.
This
swerve,
is madman
right?
theory, yeah. This is what Lawrence Friedman has written about in the New Statesman this week. This is why, without even the benefit of a PPE degree, I already know about this.
Oh, yeah. Right, okay. Well, I actually have a history degree, but I didn't realize.
How do you know about this?
I didn't realize that we'd written about swerving and non-swerving participants, but now I do, and you, like me, can buy it tomorrow in stores. Basically, the problem is the UK is not a non-swerving participant. The UK economy cannot come out without significant damage from a direct head-on collision. The difficulty is a large chunk of people running the British government seem to believe it might, and they also think that the threat that they will do so is credible. On the EU side, maybe then there will be some moment in the summer next year when people go like, oh, maybe the UK is crazy enough to do it. So far, that hasn't happened, so that approach isn't really working.
They could have worked all that stuff out and then, I don't know, like, knock £10 billion off it, but still kind of come to it right. They could have at least kind of come up with a formula, even if the formula came up with a number that was unacceptably low, right?
And then, yeah, and then that allows you
don't really seem to have done that.
Have, like, parked that enough to move on to the sort of crucial stuff. Because actually, the money stuff is, from a UK kind of national interest perspective, is really open and shut. It's a lot of money in terms of, like, even buying a football team, it's quite a lot of money. But in terms of, like, the actual size of the UK economy, 40 billion, 50 billion, you are just talking about an amount of money that you're just very willing to go, like, of course we'll pay this for.
Do you know what's beginning to really annoy me, though, which is that almost every raft of this negotiation seems to be geared to getting as close as possible back to kind of what we currently have, but with controls on immigration, right? that's what I'm just feeling a lot of. We're just kind of, like, there was a talk about kind of copying and pasting trade deals, right? It seems like the best exit from the EU is basically like exactly like EU membership, but without accepting freedom of movement. And you just think, I think we wish we could have probably worked a little bit harder at that before the whole referendum business.
Well, I think, I mean, the thing is that ultimately, like, you can't very easily, as I say in my column this week, you can't very easily get out of free movement while remaining in the EU. I think actually the problem for all, you know, instinctively, I think, you know, free movement is great. On the whole, we should have more, not less of it. You know, we should be seeking to, you know, increase the movement of people between nation states, not decrease it. But you probably could, in the Brexit negotiations, if all you cared about as the UK government was, we look, want as close a relationship as we have now, but we need some kind of action on free movement, right? You probably can get that if that's literally all you care about. If you don't care about sovereignty, right, if you're just willing to accept, like, then you follow all the rules but you don't set them, you probably could get a comprehensive deal where we don't leave the EU other than the free movement of people. And this is the slight problem with the Brexit vote, right? If you look at what ordinary people who voted to leave actually want, nothing to change, people not to get poorer, and sovereignty, which is just an abstract concept and no one really cares about, is one that would command a great deal of public support. If you basically have like a Norway deal, but instead of fish, which was the big political issue, you have migration, right? The difficulty is that is not acceptable to basically any Brexiteer in the political class, because what they really care about is the chimera of our own trade deals and sovereignty. There are probably four plausible types of Brexit that the government could try and seek. And instead, it's not even they've gone with like all of them, because at least then that would be a process where opposition parties, the EU27, could go, well, you can't have all of them, you need to pick one. Instead, they have this weird thing where they're kind of doing half of the things you would do to pursue
an immigration Brexit, and half of the things from a sovereignty Brexit.
And, yeah, it's just like, and actually, ultimately, like, you do kind of have to decide which one of those you know, like, and this is why, although I think it is fair to say Labour have a hard Brexit and not the Brexit policy I think is best for Britain, being in the customs union is just a massive order of magnitude different in terms of, among other things, the Irish border than not being in it.
Yeah.
Because if you have the same customs regime and you don't need to have customs checks, and you basically broadly accept that, like, people will be able to a few people who are Polish citizens may, you know, shock horror, get jobs in Northern Ireland, then you can have, like, the situation as it exists now, partly because no one in the EU wants there to be a hard border and no one in the UK. But what you can't do is have this weird fictitious Brexit that we are currently trying to pursue.
And if you'd like to hear more of Stephen ranting about the EU, why not subscribe to Morning Call, where he does it every single morning from
the 4th of September. And now it's time for a little feature we like to call
You Ask Us.
Indeed.
So this week you have asked us, following the statement by Laura Pidcock, a newly elected MP for Durham, I'm going to say North East, gave an interview to Squawk Box, which is one of these new alternative media sites you've heard so much about, in which she said, you know, I'm not here to make friends. I don't really think I'll be socialising with any Conservatives while I'm here. And this kind of has been interpreted as like, basically, can you be friends with a Tory?
Even though she did actually mean Tory MPs, which is like quite a different, like, it's a big difference between, like, could you be friends with
a Tory voter, someone who has voted lots of different ways, but like the last election voted Tory, and somebody who is a lifelong Conservative. So I have quite strong thoughts on this, because I have been researching and reading the work of James Graham, who you may know wrote This House, the play, which focuses on the period between 1974 and 79. And the big thing that he does in that play that is, I think, really interesting and runs very counter to the current mood is that the central relationship in is between Jack Wetherill, who is the deputy chief whip for the Tories, and Walter Harrison, who's the deputy chief whip for Labour. And it shows them as two men who have huge ideological disagreements, actually big kind of almost class disagreements, although Jack Wetherill left school, I think, at 17 and became a tailor and always used to carry a thimble in his pocket to remind him of where he came from. But, you know, they're from a time when the class split in the parties was just really, really obvious. But the core of that play is about them essentially treating each other as, you know, respectful opponents, which, as I think, is a different idea about how Parliament works than the Laura Pidcock ideal. I don't think those two people would have been friends necessarily, but they certainly respected each other. And I think that to me is the kind of key question. And why I don't like the way this is being framed is that I just think some of the language that gets used on the left about the idea of Tories being evil and voting on stuff that sends people to their deaths and stuff like that, I just think turns politics from politics into something quasi-religious. And it's actually usually more helpful, rather than to think of people being evil, than structures being in need of reform.
The thing is, though, is you can draw a direct line between public policy and people's deaths, right? So, like, there is a moral quality to politics and the political process.
Yeah, but no one's hands are clean. This is what I think is, you know, you're talking about the fact that Jeremy Corbyn refused to condemn Maduro in Venezuela, sort of sending tanks against his own people. Like, I just don't think you will, if you go through, no matter how much you agree with a politician or think they're overall a really good thing, you are not going to find a completely unblemished record. Like Harriet Harman, a politician whom I love, who I think has done incredible things for equality, the reason that she first resigned from the initial Blair cabinet was because she had to carry through welfare cuts that were necessary because Gordon Brown had promised that they would keep to the spending limit set out by the Tories. And, you know, she says now, I think I should have argued hard against them. I'm sure there were people who suffered deeply as a result of those cuts, but whose political career doesn't involve some decisions they regret, some things they sacrifice for the greater good, some things they had to do.
But nonetheless, I think it is okay for people to draw an individual line where they go, like, actually, past this point, I think these are immoral behaviours and immoral acts, right? So I think that bit is perfectly legitimate. I thought the interesting thing about the row was not the row about what she actually said, but the kind of weird meta row of, like, can people be friends across, like, the political divide, where one I thought was interesting because I thought there was a surprising amount of disingenuousness on both sides, in that, one, obviously, she wasn't saying, I have no friends who are Tories. But two, like, everyone has a friend who they talk to about, like, stamp collecting or football or fine wines or their preferred tablecloths.
Big foundation of many friendships.
Or whatever, right? Where they do not know the politics of that person.
Well, that's what I thought was really interesting and actually revealing of a certain type of kind of blinkeredness about the people having this conversation is, you know, there are a lot of people in Britain who just don't think about politics that often. Like, their only engagement with politics is, if anything, voting every 5 years, right? This is the thing I thought was fascinating, was this assumption that actually, oh, people, you know how people make their friendships based around their ideological convictions in this, defined in this very narrow party political way, which I'm sure is true for most political journalists, most MPs, most people who work at a think tank or as a SPAD, but I'm just not sure is that true of somebody who works in a call centre or on a checkout or as a teacher, maybe.
But I think the thing is that is true of everyone. It's very hard to have, and actually I think this is why I think, although I think the moral characterization is fine, I think the difficulty is that actually what really inhibits friendship is a lack of respect, right? And a lack of sincere good wishes. And although there are some MPs who are genuine friends across the political divide, the difficulty is it is hard to have a proper friendship with someone who you are secretly hoping loses their job. I don't think it's a coincidence that lots of the great cross-party friendships like Enoch Powell and Tony Benn, for example, were two people who for most of their political careers, there was no real possibility, other than in 83, where the boundary changes went very heavily against Benn in his Bristol seat, where there was a prospect that the other one needed to lose their job for the other's politic to
succeed. I'm so amused at the thought of telling angry people on Twitter about the fact that Tony Benn was friends with Enoch Powell.
The thing is, I do think it is reasonable to think less of someone who is friends with someone who uses terms like rivers of blood and doesn't go, mate, what are you on? I do think it is acceptable for rivers of blood to be a line in the sand, which you're like, I can't be friends with someone who holds...
Yeah, but this kind of comes back to the... And I something that's a thought I've been gestating for a while about what I think of as a kind of the scrutiny economy and what things... You know, we have this conversation a lot about what things you're willing to let pass because you think overall someone is good. And I think that Tony Benn benefits from a huge kind of, oh, but overall he was a good thing and I agree with him. And he's therefore given a pass on lots of stuff that is a bit... And actually, you wouldn't have... I don't think people on the internet wouldn't give Harriet Harman a pass had she been friends with Enoch Powell, right?
Yeah, but I think, I mean, this is kind of a lot of the problem I have with a lot of sort of intra-left and indeed left-wing conversations about the right, where people go like, yeah, but so-and-so wouldn't give Exapass, right? So you know that girl who, when she was 14, like, sent a bunch of racist tweets, and she went to university and joined the Labour Party, and she introduced Jeremy Corbyn, and then people were like, oh, she sent all these awful things when she was 14. And lots of people were like, oh, but, you know, people wouldn't be sympathetic to someone on the right who did this, or like this 17-year-old who set up this, like, awful, like, attempt to clone Momentum Activate, which, yes, is the most cringe thing I've ever seen. And in both cases, you have this thing where people go like, but the other side wouldn't forgive this child, therefore I shouldn't. At some point, I think you do have to decide to unilaterally disarm and be the person who goes, actually, I am going to forgive
this child for their ill-advised
thing. I am going to be as tolerant of Tony Benn and Enoch Powell. And I do think Powell is different. But
no, I had that argument with them. I had that argument with Aaron Bastani of Novara Media about who published someone's private Facebook conversation. And I said, I don't see how you can sit there and honk on about, oh, tabloids are so bad, and then do that and totally invade someone's privacy. And his response was, you know, kind of like, no, you have to expect that. People have done that to me. And I'd agree, my response is exactly the same, which is that, you know, do as you would be done to is in some ways as a recipe for ongoing low-level shittiness, right?
Yeah.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Helen Lewis, and my co-host, Stephen Bush. We are recorded by India Burke and produced by Caroline Crampton. Our theme music is from Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. Why not subscribe to Stephen's morning call? God knows it'll make him happy, and I think that's probably one of the only things that's important in life. It starts again on Monday, September the 4th, and you can find it at newstatesman.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.